Good afternoon. Hello. Welcome. Lovely to see you all. We're really delighted that Emma Hart has been able to come and chat with Dean Kenning. And I hope that most of you have seen the show upstairs before the talk started. But if you haven't, don't worry, because the show will be open when we finish. And it's just upstairs on the left. And so the title of this talk, as you will all know, is Dean Kenning's Stuck Machines. And the focus of the talk today is particularly on Dean's kinetic sculptures. So Dean works in lots of interesting and different ways, but today the focus is on his kinetic work. So because we haven't printed out in the interest of the planet, I'll just let you know, read their biographies to remind you of who we have sitting here. So Emma Hart lives and works in London, and in 2016 she won the Max Mara Art Prize for Women in collaboration with the Whitechapel Gallery. And in 2015 she was awarded a Paul Hamlin Foundation Award for Visual Art. She's had lots of interesting solo exhibitions recently and many group exhibitions internationally. And she completed her PhD in fine art at Kingston University in 2013 and is lecturing at the Slade now. And Dean is an artist and a writer, and his work ranges from the kinetic sculptures that we have upstairs and videos and diagrams. We have a couple of videos that are showing on the screen, so again we'll switch it on at the end of the show. And there are some of his diagram work around the room in here, and actually these are extremely reasonable limited editions for sale, so you might like to look at them more closely later. And Dean has had a number of solo exhibitions recently and has got another one coming up at Matt's Gallery in June, and he's a member of the Capital Drawing Group and the Social Morphologies Research Unit. And the Social Morphologies Research Unit has just opened a collaborative show at Space. Space Gallery. And that would be really interesting to go and see, because there's collaborations between artists and anthropologists. And I think that opened a couple of days ago, and there's an event next week. He's a researcher at Kingston School of Art and teaches fine art at Central St Martin's. So upcoming for Dean is Morphologies of Invisible Agents at Space, and then Cannibal Metaphysics and Diagramming Politics is an event that will be happening as part of that exhibition on the 4th of May at 2 o'clock. And the preview for the Matt's Gallery exhibition is on the 7th of June. So I'm sure we'd be really happy to see you there. Anyway, I'll stop talking now and hand over to Emma. Thank you very much. In fact, Drs. Hart and Dr. Kenny, please continue.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. okay. So, Dean, my first question to you is about your use of silicon upstairs. It's featured before in your work, and certainly, obviously, it's upstairs in those floppy, literally pointless body parts or fingers that are playing the keyboards. Why do you like using silicon?
Why do I like using silicon?
Have you used it? Should we look at it? This is another silicon.
Yeah, I
work
can
here.
Show you this. It's weird, this PowerPoint, because the other one will start. There you go. Right, so, silicon. How did it all get started with silicon?
Yeah, what is it about silicon?
It's my rubber fetish you're asking about.
Well...
What I'm drawn to is... I'll turn this down. Right, so what I'm interested in is the kind of aesthetics of movement, really. And there's a particular quality with the silicon rubber. So these are, I call these pieces plants. I kind of call them like plants or rubber plants. They're not necessarily plants, but I just call them that. And I tend to work in, with these kind of series of works. So for example, the keyboard works, I've done various iterations of those. The same with the plant ones. I'm planning to do one of these for the Matt's Gallery show. And I'm interested in the kind of aesthetic effect of this kind of slightly fetishistic, strange material, and particularly what I do with it, which is kind of make casts in tubes, put them together, and then get them moving. And it has this kind of visceral quality, I suppose. And to me, something which is approaching something a bit skin-like, something a bit perverse, something which has lots of kind of associations with the body, but is not representative of anything as such. But it has these kind of... I'm kind of interested in kind of triggering certain kind of primal responses. And this silicon material does that. So I started using it for one thing, and then I ended up using it for something else. So that's how it works. So I made the kind of plant pieces before starting to use them to kind of hammer the notes of keyboards, which just seemed like a kind of logical next step, or maybe an illogical next step, but it's kind of what happened. You know, a lot of it's just kind of playing about with stuff in the studio and seeing what's happening.
We've spoken before, but silicon is particularly good at being dumb.
Yeah, so thanks. I am... That is what I'm kind of after, making art which is quite dumb and idiotic and stupid. And I think sculpture is quite dumb. I mean, it's literally dumb. It's about the kind of dumbness of materials and what you do with that.
A big thing in front of it, a big dumb thing.
It is just a thing, yeah. It's like that joke about whatever tripping over the sculpture as you
back up to see the painting.
Exactly, but I do think that's true, and that's what I'm. I mean, there's another kind of side. You know, there's another kind of side about this, which is the fact that I'm against serious art, in the sense that for me there's certain kind of signifiers of seriousness. So I'm trying to, you know, avoid those kind of signifiers by making something which seems kind of explicitly dumb or explicitly idiotic in a way, and that goes both for the kinetics, which is you know, a rightfully much maligned art form. I mean, most kinetic art is really bad, and I'm not particularly interested in kinetic art as an art form, and part of the reason I got into it was because it was quite looked down upon, right. You know. I mean, it seems to be everywhere now. There seems to be loads of kinetic art.
Okay.
But, so dumb. Yeah, you're right. It is dumb.
And it's neurotic and compulsive. I suppose when I went to see the show upstairs, when I encounter a piece of artwork, I try to sort of assess or think about it through clear decisions that you've made or that the artist has made. And those those silicon fingers or whatever body parts, I was trying to think how different it would have been if they'd been rigid and the movement, that if they may have ended up playing the keyboard better, I don't know. But the fact that they're wobbly and compulsive and neurotic and agitated is a word that I think you would probably use. I don't know. Yeah, and because one of the things I've heard you or we've spoken about before is you use the word vitalism, and I get a bit agitated when I hear that word because I don't actually really know what it means. Could you tell me?
Yes. Okay, I'll talk about vitalism, and then I'll go back to the fingers.
Yeah, or maybe, if it's not, I thought, is it connected?
I like the kind of joke you made about point. You know, it's pointless. They're pointless.
Yeah, the fingers are pointless. They have no internal structure.
Yeah, they're not tapering to.
No, exactly. And they can't point to anything.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. So they're not particularly proficient pianists. Let's say you know they are really. It is pretty hit and miss.
Yeah.
You know, if you see the work, they're often like hitting two notes at once. You know, it's almost like if you're a toddler and you're just hammering kind of. So it's very much, I guess the idea of pointing is pointing seems to suggest some kind of intentionality and some kind of plan and some kind of like, right, I'm here and I'm going to get over there. But it's also rooter point, isn't it? So, you know, these things are, they really don't know where they're going or they don't know why they're doing what they're doing. They just have to do it. I mean, I'm speaking as if they're, you know, living things, which maybe brings us on to the vitalism question. So as far as I understand vitalism, I mean, it's not looked upon, as anything.
Underrated.
Well, not just disrespected, really.
Okay.
Rightfully, probably. But it's the sense that life is more than the sum of its parts.
Right.
You know, that you could look under all kind of microscopes and so on to find out what constitutes life. But you'd never actually get to life. So it's kind of associated with these disreputable ideas of like. A living force, or the ghost in the machine, or you know, spontaneous generation. So all those kind of things that were proved wrong with the kind of Enlightenment and with kind of modern science and so on. But I still think there's something to the idea that it's not the sum of its parts. There's something weird. There's something kind of weird about life that we can't, or at least I can't, get beyond the weirdness of it. You know, I know we're both fans of David Attenborough, but I remember watching Life on Earth, you know, when I was a kid, and the thing that was really fascinating for me wasn't so much the animals and stuff themselves, but when he looked at like what was like, you know, he looked at the kind of cells. The dividing cells, which to me was a bit like, you know, cutting a worm in half and the worm kind of, you know, wriggles off in both directions, and it's so freaky. So there's something freaky and uncanny about life itself, which I think can be it can be intimated with art which moves. And it's a kind of primal. It's a primal thing. It's something about seeing something move and kind of believing in a way that it is alive, and that is maybe that's what life is.
Yeah. So we have a kind of specific encounter, or a different encounter with an artwork or with things that move, rather than things that don't move. It kind of gets us here rather than here.
I think it's affective. I think. I mean, it's, you could say it's psychotropic. You know, I mean,
don't
somebody.
Say that, I don't know what that means.
I mean, you know, like I don't know, like well, a couple of people said it's like kind of.
Okay.
You know, you could, you know, take drugs or something.
Oh, okay.
You know.
I know what that means. Yeah.
let's say it kind of, you know, maybe affect might be that you're triggering some kind of neuronal response in the brain, which is not it's not about consciousness. It touches on something deeper than that. I don't know. Maybe I'm claiming too much for what I'm doing, but that I think that, you know, that's where I kind of think about it now. That's what. With it, and bearing in mind it is all dumb, so I'm not, if I sound pretentious, it is like it is all dumb, but there's a kind of dumb way in which you can trigger a response that something deep inside us recognizes something moving as being alive. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what life is.
And
there's something slightly disturbing about that, the fact that things move and wriggle about and are not just like rocks.
Well, we'll talk about it a bit later, but they're kind of out of our control, maybe, as well. I'm going to go on to number two now. Is that okay? I've got these notes. And actually, at number two, it says... We both hate composition or composing, and that word is particularly relevant here because they're upstairs these dumb silicon body parts are playing musical instruments. like we just sort of spoke about, the work is kind of out of control. And then it says, hallelujah. and I was thinking... I was thinking about upstairs, but I was also thinking about an old work of yours called Man Machines.
And I've got it right here, as it happens.
Dean said something, we're friends, right, so we talk a lot, and he said something really interesting to me last time he spoke. The reason he started making kinetic work was to escape composition. But perhaps we can just look at, here they are, the Man Machines.
So the Man Machines were the first kinetic work I made, and I made them almost immediately after leaving art college. I went to Goldsmiths, and I guess, despite everything, the kind of work I did at my degree show was quite... Goldsmith looking at that time. In other words, I tried to make stuff that looked a bit kind of slick and kind of conceptual at the same time. And then as soon as I left, I just thought, this is all nonsense. Like, really, this is really, like, I just don't believe it anymore. Partly because I didn't have a studio or workshops or any money. And so I that, you know, it's a long time ago, you know, it's before MP3s, so people were using like CD Walkman things. So these were all getting the old cassette Walkmans and all the various makes of these kind of portable cassette machines were all getting, people getting rid of them basically. I'd go to Brick Lane Market and there'd be loads of these things. So I'd buy them very, very cheap, car boot sales and markets and stuff. And a lot of them didn't work when I got, you know, as always, you know, you buy these things, they don't work. But so I'd get them working and then I'd just re-engineer them. So the tape mechanism would become this little arm that knocked up against... the gallery wall. It was a bit like an attack on the gallery wall, but again, like the white cube. But again, all of it is a little bit like a joke. I mean, even calling them Man Machines, which had this sense of sci-fi and craft work and all this, but these were like really crap man machines. You know, they were just like, reconstituted old Walkmans, and sometimes they'd play a bit of tape. Actually, I put a bit of tape around them, and they'd actually have earphones, so you could listen to like this loop of just nothing. But because it was a loop, it would seem to become music, because anything on a loop is, that's what music is, as far as I understand. It's just something repeated. So it was kind of it was a kind of move to like try to create something that looked a bit like minimal art or something, or Damien Hirst or something, to like having no money and just using stuff that had been thrown away, and to do, I guess, to do something humorous with it, but also to do something which wouldn't just kind of sit in a gallery or something and just sit there waiting. It would just kind of perform, and it wouldn't care about an audience or whether anyone saw it or anything. And it would also, you know, it's also kind of pushing itself into a state of auto-destruct. I mean, I wouldn't recommend doing kinetic art to anyone, because it's really masochistic.
I was going to talk about that, because that's quite a big thing to say. We both hate composition or composing. Like, and what I mean is I hate arranging things in a gallery. Like, it is the worst part of art making for me, when you've made the stuff and then you've got to arrange it. And because what you're talking about, I work with ceramics and clay, and one of the things I think that is similar perhaps between Dean working with motors and me with clay is basically we have an idea. This is how I understand it. We have an idea, and then the battle commences, and I have to go into battle with clay, and you have to go into battle with motors. Motors want to be disco balls. Clay wants to be a pot. And you have to have this big battle and try and get it to like do what you want it to do, and it doesn't want to do it. And then there's this kind of dialectical process where you're just got to persuade this material to do this thing that you want it to do, and then it has other ideas, and then your idea gets pushed through this kind of process of fighting with the material, and then by the end, as long as it's moving and in my case not cracked, that's it, my work's done. Do you know what I mean? And then the very last thing I want to do is then go and stick that in a nice way in a gallery. And I just, because this kind, yeah, I don't know, this kind of battle with materials or motors doesn't leave any room for composition at the end. I don't know. Our work is just getting the thing to work.
Working, yeah. And keeping it,
keeping it that way.
No, totally, yeah. It's a kind of ethic, right? It's a kind of method, I think has a kind of ethic, you know, maybe even a politics attached to it. There seems something very arbitrary about composition, mm-hmm. the fact that it should look like it should be this way rather than this way. It's, you know, often these things end up in a certain way that you're happy with. The way this worked out with this exhibition upstairs is I did it in quite a short space of time. I managed to get 21 keyboards together.
That's important. But any keyboards, you know, there's no quality control on those keyboards. Any keyboard will do.
Well, as long as they're cheap. Yeah. That's the only kind of criteria. I'm not, you know. Yeah. They've all gone up in price because they're all vintage, you know. They're all, you know.
My mum won't let my daughter play with our. She's got one, my toy, in case she breaks it, because she thinks it's worth money.
Yeah, no. So I mean, yeah, I don't. Yeah, I would. I don't know. I mean, it's funny because some of those keys, they probably were quite expensive at the time, like, you know, and then they just became like obsolete. Like, they became obsolete very quickly, and then they become kind of vintage. But I swear, some of the, you know, some of the ones that are advertised on eBay as vintage, they're just crap, you know, they're really not. But the point being that if I'd had more time, there would be more than 21. If I'd had less time, there would be less than 21. And people have said to me things like, oh, no, I think you've just got exactly the right number.
But there's no mystery there.
Yeah, I kind of agree. But actually, it's wrong, because if there was more, it would just be different. Mm. It wouldn't be the wrong number or something. It would just be a different thing. So I have no kind of it's quite nice, because I don't have to worry about what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
Those kind of things. So yeah, like you say, it's like my job is to get them working and arrange them in a way which then is kind of navigatable by people in the space. So they're very kind of practical concerns, actually.
Yeah.
And the approach is very it stops you worrying about all those. I mean, there's something about composition which is, I think, it is quite arrogant.
I sort of associate composition with kind of privilege, really. Like, yeah, you've got the time or the whatever. You've got to worry about whether the blue is five centimetres away from the red or whatever. I don't know. A kind of a privilege there. Or if you're composing your record collection at home or arranging something that is somehow associated with some kind of expertise or expertise. And I don't know, that it's kind of...
It's kind of imposing your vision, or it's imposing your kind of
onto
the world. And the world is not like the world is not really like that. The world is it is random and contingent, and we do live in terms of what's available when. These kind of practicalities to do with money, to do with time, and that kind of idea that you prefer, this colour next to that colour,
or even just this thing next to that thing.
It does seem like a completely random kind of notion. Why do you think this thing should be next to that thing in that particular order? It is a kind of imposition upon the world, I think. It's a kind of rationalisation of something that's not actually rational. So, yeah, it has those connotations of privilege, I suppose, in that sense that you have a kind of overview of things that you've then decided what the right arrangement should be.
And why do you think, specifically making kinetic work, short circuits composition?
When I started making it, well, these things are not conscious, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't necessarily, and I totally agree with you about the battle, like you say, the fact that ideas don't come from your head. Ideas come from the work, right? And how you get to the work is through some kind of process that, again, you're not totally in control of. I mean, something's triggered some attachment, some kind of obsession, probably, and you don't really know exactly where that's come from. But then you follow that through, and you follow it through with the material, and certain things happen, and then something comes out the other end. But that thing that comes out is also a result of how much time you've got, how much money you've got, what help you've got.
Because you're doing it all yourself, aren't you?
Yeah. So yeah. I think the DIY, the kind of DIY element is, I think it's quite healthy, actually. In terms of making art, because, like you say, I am an amateur in these kind of matters. You know, I do look at YouTube videos to find out how things work. I do consult other people. I'm my friend Lee Holden here in the audience, who was a big collaborator really on the piece upstairs in terms of working with the sensors and so on. But I am totally focused on getting the things working, figuring out ways of, for example, how do I get these keyboards to work for like 4 weeks, 5 weeks non-stop? That is quite a problem.
Well,
and that's what my concern is.
I was going to ask you about that, because the origin of life upstairs is technically an interactive installation.
It isn't, yeah. So again, it's like I'm not. It's actually.
So what brought that about? Yeah.
Maybe I can show you another. Maybe I can show you this.
Okay.
Just because this is so. Like I say, like I've done these works for keyboards, and this is an earlier iteration, and this is not interactive.
No.
The reason it's not interactive is this is not at all dependent on. It's not triggered by the movement of. People in the space. Okay, they're on timers. The reason they're on timers is partly it kind of creates a certain musical dynamic when things go on and off. They're all playing together now. This is from Embassy Gallery in Edinburgh a few years ago. But the real reason they're on timers, to be honest, is because I don't want them to break. And they're less likely to break if they're not on constantly, right? So that is the way I think about the work. Like, how do I not make them break?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll put them on timers. Now, I put them on timers, and something interesting happens is that I might as well, they're on timers, I might as well put them on different timers for different times. They go on and off at different times. Now, having this show on for an even longer time with more keyboards, I was faced with this problem. Even with timers, they're likely to break, right? Because they're more likely to break because they're on for longer time. Okay, if they're on sensors, so they only turn on, and bear in mind there's no one upstairs invigilating the show. I couldn't ask someone to practically turn them on and off every time someone comes in. Okay, so that's the solution, right? The solution is they only turn on when someone comes in the space. The rest of the time, they're just resting. And as long as they're resting, I'm a bit more happy because I know they're not wearing themselves out. They're not doing work, and they're not kind of to be honest, David from the gallery texted me yesterday. Okay, one of them's died, right? So the orange Bontempi, aww, which a lot of people are very fond of. I'm not that fond of it in a way, because I think the sound it makes is not that nice, personally, but it looks nice. You know, it's that one there. Okay, it's broken, it's given up, it's died, right? So if we can talk about the fact that it's died, we can talk about the fact that these things are alive in some sense. Maybe it's all metaphorical, I don't know. But it's dead, okay? The finger's still going, so it's, you know, it's literally flogging a dead horse at this stage. But, yeah, this is the point. I have done an interactive work. I'm not a particular fan of interactive works. Again, I mostly...
Or kinetic,
But I've been really, really pleasantly surprised of what's happened, because actually this piece is... It's much, for me, although they're agitated and so on and neurotic and so on, there's something quite mellow about it as well compared to how I showed them here, for example. There's a kind of mellowness and even, dare I say it, a kind of musical quality, which was never my intention because, as you say, I don't compose.
Don't do composing.
And I wouldn't dream of composing music for this kind of kinetic work. But they've become musical, you know, quite against any intention or any plan or any scoring or any program or anything like that. That's just simply what's happened through my problem solving.
Or could we say the work knows more than you?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, definitely. The work, yeah, the work.
The work knows.
Yeah,
what,
yeah, yeah, the work. I mean, the show. Well, maybe I can. Maybe this is a good opportunity to. The funny thing about this, when I go backwards, it's not going to work.
Oh, because I'm going backwards up my notes.
Because I tried this, but let me.
I'll talk.
Yeah, you carry
I'll
on.
I'll talk. Well, I'm going to go back up because we went anyway. I was going to read this out. This is something. I think you've probably all read it, but these sculptures confront the. This is what the description of. Upstairs. These sculptures confront the viewer as agitated living things. The artist's aim is to create a work elusive of an uncanny vitalism, that word, associated with nature and life itself. Portraying this through simple mechanical means troubles ideas of life and non-life. I have gone up, but it will come out, but I had a question about that that I thought we could just sort of think about. And it was, does liveness equal lifeness? And then, yeah, this is Renaissance man. he's is he a live work? Is upstairs a live work? Life work?
Upstairs is a live work. This is. I'm not sure if this is a live work.
Okay.
This is about life.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it's I don't know if it's live.
Okay.
I'm not sure. What do you think? The reason upstairs would be live is that literally it would never be the same twice. I mean, I've been hanging around here a lot. I've been doing various minor repairs and just checking on things and meeting people. But it would never be the same upstairs for me every time I go around it, because it will always not only depend on the route I take around the works, but it would also depend on exactly where the fingers are placed and how they play the notes. So it is live because it absolutely depends on your presence in the space to make it work, and it will never be the same twice.
So that, I mean...
Whereas this is just repetitive. This will always kind of...
Which is life.
It's, well, I don't... Yeah, I don't...
Okay.
I don't think this is any more live than a painting or something.
Okay.
Like, I mean, obviously nothing's going to be the same twice. You know, there's no such thing as repetition and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think this is any more live than a painting would be. Whereas this work upstairs is live. Look, just like, if I can bring you in here. Emma,
yeah.
Just like your work with the cameras, for example, your show at Matt's Gallery.
At Matt's Gallery, yeah. Well, one of the things I was interested in there is... is similar in that I was trying to show. This is, it's a show I did at Matt's Gallery in 2011, with a bit like upstairs, in that there were cameras that were working. They were actually sort of filming, and they had lots of stuff stuck to them, silly stuff. And but one of the things I was always trying to think about is the encounter. Like, well, what's the encounter? What is on offer in the encounter with an artwork? And I don't really like work with complete. I don't really like complete objects or complete things. I like fragments, and because the. When we were in Asda, I go on about this quite a lot, but, you know, when we were in Asda looking for the baked beans, we're confronted, obviously, with loads of stuff, which is sort of... and we have to kind of navigate our own way through it. So I'm interested in liveness, and for me, liveness is a form of an encounter where there's just basically too much stuff going on upstairs or in my show, so you can't take it all in at once, and it's going to be different each time, and therefore, and it's a lot, and it's different to how we sometimes encounter work in a gallery where we might see complete paintings or something, and we can step back and think, oh, that's nice. I want it to be more frenetic or chaotic, so that there's it's for me, it's a lifelike encounter, if that makes sense. But liveness does contribute to lifeness, because liveness, you're right, that is live up there, and it will be different each time that we see it, and that's what happened in Matt's gallery. It's something to do with control. It's something to do with where the artist is not in control of the situation. I really value the moment where that there isn't a hierarchy. We want to make art where the artist doesn't know more than the viewer. So it's not like, so one of the reasons I stopped making video art is I didn't like the idea that I knew what was going to happen next in the video, and people watching it didn't know. I knew that the dog was going to come in or whatever at 3 minutes, but the viewer didn't, because I'd put the dog there. And so there is this kind of hierarchy set up where the artist is, like, the artist knows what's going on and the viewer doesn't. So I want it to be non-hierarchical. I don't know what's going to happen in Matt's gallery. You've got no idea. You don't really know what's going on upstairs. Mm-hmm. And nor does the viewer know what's going on either. So, and I suppose I kind of think about that as it being more of a situation than a...
I think, yeah, I think when you put it like that, I think it does have something to do with life, actually. It's quite profound, actually. I think it's to do... I think about artificial, you know, like artificial life, would have to be that would have to be the way computers go, right? That it would have to go in that direction of a kind of loss of control.
That's the problem, I suppose, with the way they're designing artificial intelligence now. They're making it too intelligent.
I totally agree with you about video. I mean, I have got a video here. It's not on at the moment, but it's a video. Some people have seen it. It's a video of it's basically kind of some Tory politicians kind of melting, like their faces are melting, and that's okay. But I would love it if I was not in control of the particular politician or the particular way they melted. That would maybe be something I would do next with video. Like a lot of this work, you know, when we talk about losing control, we are the kind of authors in some way of the work, but the way I see it is we set a set of parameters. What are the parameters? Right, so partly the parameters would be, okay, we have to be quite practical about the situation, the particular situation. It might be the space, it might be the time, it might be the, you know, whatever you got. But there's a particular set of parameters. Now, you want to set those parameters wide enough that we can be surprised by what happens. We're not in control of what happens. So I don't know exactly how these keyboards are going to operate. I don't know which ones are going to be triggered. I don't know how musical it's going to be. And therefore this...
Also, you don't know how many people are going to be in the room?
No. Of course. You can't... Yeah, no, of course you can't control that.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe the work is more honest if it owns up to that. I think maybe this is the reason. This goes back to the reason, you know, like a lot of people, I don't know, but at least when I did my degree show, you kind of do the degree show as if it's like some exhibition at the Tate or something, as if the work, you know, and it's completely fake actually.
Yeah.
So if you, maybe it's more honest to see the work, and you know, maybe we'll go on to talk about this in terms of autonomy.
Yeah.
But
it's next. Yeah.
Okay, I've kind of lost the train, but I wanted, the reason I brought this
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I was going to say, can,
is because,
let's talk about this.
The reason I brought this up, firstly, is just because you said the work knows more than we do.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer in that.
Yeah, I'm a big, me too.
I don't think we really know that much in terms of how we understand our lives or what goes on. I don't think we're in control of much, actually, at all. I think, consciousness and is a bit of an illusion. It's an illusion that we do kind of lose it sometimes, and it's a bit scary if we lose it. And that, you know, that might be an effect of drugs or some particular situation. But there's those moments where we feel a bit out of control, and that's probably closer to the truth. So conscious awareness is a bit of a kind of illusion that we're able to kind of tell a story about ourselves. But actually there's probably at least 90% of what happens is it's kind of other stuff, you know, it's other things coming through. And I think that is what the value of art is. It is that you kind of, it's a kind of manifestation of that not knowing. So this was a work that, this particular work, I originally made it about almost 20 years ago in a much rougher state than this, actually. I say rougher, I just mean I had less money to spend on it, and I completely did it all myself, and it was quite a dangerous thing, and absolutely nobody saw it. I mean, maybe like 20 people saw it or something, and it almost killed me making it. But when I showed it at Piper Keys, which is not this version, but a slightly different version, the show was called Where It Was, which is it's a quote from Freud. And the full quote is where it was, there I will be. And it's the idea that the it or the id is always there in front of you. It's always there before you. So your kind of consciousness or your kind of awareness catches up with what's already happened, where there's a kind of other knowing, and that other knowing could come through the work. And for me, that is manifest. I mean, I experience that when I do the work. It's only later that I can kind of stand back and kind of reflect upon, oh, okay,
yeah,
that's why I did that. This is my current interpretation of why I did that.
Why did you, why is it a trough?
Okay, yeah, that's good.
Do you know the answer?
No,
do you know the answer to that now?
I do.
Okay.
I do, because that's where it all started for me, or
yeah,
that's my current interpretation of where it all started.
Well,
I used to spend...
I'm interested in containers. In containers.
The trough was the original point for this work, Renaissance Man. So this came directly after the little man machines, the little kind of Walkmans. And again, Renaissance Man is a kind of parodic, ironic, kind of sarcastic kind of title, right? Like Leonardo da Vinci or something like that. But I used to spend far too much time on buses. I used to have a job which meant I had to get a bus. I had to get the 38 bus. They used to call it the love bus. I won't go into that. But apparently the three and the eight, it formed a heart in the middle. So they called it the love bus. And... actually, buses are hard. I don't get many buses these days. I live very close to a tube station. I get tubes. But there's a lot more life, in a way, on a bus.
Yeah.
And buses are kind of crazy. And I would spend, at least an hour and a half every day on a bus. And something really got to me. It kind of annoyed me, but kind of fascinated me, and that was the fact that there was always a half-empty LucasAid bottle. See, this is it, right? Yeah, there was a half-empty LucasAid bottle kind of rolling backwards and forwards.
No one's going to pick it up.
On the bus, and at some point it would come towards me. And
oh, you would.
No, I wouldn't pick it up. No, nobody would pick it up. That's the kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it would just be there all day, like literally. Yeah. If I got on the same bus on the way home, it would be the same LucasAid bottle. So there's a kind of dumbness of a thing, right? Of an inanimate thing that's been animated, that you almost start projecting some kind of lifelike qualities onto this. You start imagining that LucasAid bottle is coming towards, like, it's going to come towards me. Like, it's always going to come towards me. Like, it's always going to hit my feet, and I'm going to be
the one.
Yeah, has to pick it up.
Yeah.
So that's really why it started. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to make a sculpture with a LucasAid bottle in it. And in the end, I didn't put the LucasAid bottle in it because the battle, as you call it, or whatever, the particular dialectical process with the actual material is suddenly this box suddenly turned into all kinds of different things, such as a seesaw, a coffin.
Yeah.
It's about the right, you know, you could all, the original one I made actually was 6 foot tall. So it was about the size of a coffin. So you could kind of get inside it. So it had all these other connotations. So the LucasAid bottle it felt like it would have been a bit too much, but that originally is why it's a trough. But then the trough takes on all these other connotations, I suppose, you know. But yeah, it's like it always kind of fascinates me where an idea comes from and how kind of stupid the idea is, and what is it about the thing that actually makes you do something, which is quite hard work, you know, like why would you do that, right? But there did seem to me something about movement and the fact that this movement on the bus would shift something. I was then going to put water in it, and the water was going to, you know, so there's all these kind of ideas, but I think in the end these things are imaginary in the sense
there was something in it, so I must have imagined something being in it. Because,
right, no.
I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Five. Autonomy. Please can you explain what you meant when you said this work upstairs is against autonomy, or the work is a parody of autonomy?
So I suppose autonomy is one of those kind of art theory terms or art history terms, and I think all artists still struggle with it. You know, we're all still kind of involved in this idea of which comes out of modernism. I mean, autonomy literally means self-rule. You know, you follow your own rules, or your
okay.
We don't want to be determined by someone else's rules or by someone else's kind of set of terms, or we don't want to be an instrument of some other process, you know. But I think, you know, so these things come from an idea of the enlightened human as being, you know, equal and free and having free will, and against these kind of God-given hierarchies and so on. But then a kind of shift seemed to happen in the 19th century with the rise of modern art, and particularly with abstraction, where it's like, well, what, you know, art should follow its own rules as well, right? Art should not be determined by some kind of other content. It shouldn't be there to glorify the church or the king or, you know, whatever it is. So it follows its own rules. So, but what then seemed to happen, I'm going a bit art history here, but the point I'm getting to, I suppose, okay, so there seemed to be that kind of idea that art should be able to be art for art's sake, seem to separate art from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And that's where the whole institution of art, as, let's say, as kind of emblematized by the White Cube Gallery, comes in.
What I'm really against
when I talk about the fact that I'm against autonomy is I'm against the authority of the gallery, because in a way, kind of paradoxically, the idea that the artwork is separate from the rest of the world is actually a function of the authority of the gallery, which wants to separate this thing and demand the attention you should give to this thing simply because it's in the gallery and therefore it's art.
One of the sentences that sends me over the edge is when people say that art should make sense of the world, as if it's like something above us, that's in a different world and wants to make sense of our world. It kind of just, I was thinking about art is not a separate world. And I was thinking about the piece you did at James Taylor Gallery, I'm not sure Dean's got any. I'll describe it. Well, just quickly. It was a wall which was very much from the world, from my world, just some kind of shabby wall, and it had two eyes looking at me through two holes which were blinking, and basically these eyes were embedded in my world.
Yeah, it's like, I described them at the time as like a kind of bit like a B-movie special effect.
Right.
And I mean, all my work is very analog.
Yeah.
And which goes back to the pointing. I mean, pointing is digital, right? It's literally digital.
I don't know, what about Michelangelo?
Thought of Michelangelo. What I mean is there's a kind of deliberateness to the digital. It's either one thing or another, right?
Okay.
It's either this or that. It's either this or that. You know, it's either zero or one or whatever. And that's why I like particularly really quite bad old horror movie special effects, where you kind of enjoy the fact that you can kind of see it's some kind of food stuff being kind of mixed up, or you know, but at the same time, again, it's visceral, you kind of believe it, so you can do two things at once. You can kind of suspend your disbelief and enjoy the fact that it's the very fact that you know that it's not blood or gore, an eye popping out or something. Because it's some kind of material that you recognise, but because it's material, it also kind of gives you that kind of sense of recognition, which makes you feel a bit queasy or a bit kind of, like it might be your finger being cut off or something.
Well, I'm going to come to point six, which is my last point. But what I'm thinking about what you're saying is,
can I say something more about autonomy, though?
Well, I was going to.
Yeah.
I was going to. All right, go on then. Yes, please.
Because you asked me why it's a parody.
Yeah, are parodies funny? But go on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, go on. No, go on. What do you want to say more about autonomy?
Actually, this will go to your last point.
Exactly.
Yeah. Go on, ask me the question. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I was thinking about if art is not autonomous, if art is not a separate world, then we have some kind of shared experience. And I was thinking about one of the ways we might share an experience, the artwork and the viewer, and I wondered if that was what happens when an artwork is funny.
Yeah, okay.
Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I wanted to say that, you know, that your work is funny. I want to say that most art is boring, apart from mine. Like, how does being funny feed into undermining or being against autonomy?
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. So that was my problem, or that is my problem, with the kind of authority of the gallery. So what the authority of the gallery does is it seems to create value where it's not due. There you go. Why should we pay something attention?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you might say, I think attention is love, right? Attention. When you love someone or love something, you give them attention, or you give it attention, right? So there's a kind of quality that someone or something deserves or demands. It's not a rational thing, but there's something which draws you in. And I think what the institutionalization of the autonomy of art, and that sense that this thing should be separate from the rest of life, and we're going to create certain situations, we're going to learn certain modes of behavior, we're going to have all kinds of coded signals, mm-hmm. and so on, to signify the sense that we're now in the realm of art, right? This to me is a kind of authoritarian kind of imposition which demands we give attention to something that might not deserve it, because, like you say, most art is boring. I think it is, you know, and I often kind of wonder why that is, but it's a fact. At least that's how I experience it. And I suppose that was the point of kind of getting these things moving. At least there'll be something to look at.
Yeah.
At least there'll be something to look at.
Yeah.
And it won't be about the fact that this is a gallery space demanding that I look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it might be completely,
I think that's
flippant. It might be like the worst kind of special effect, if you like, or the worst kind of theatricality. Like, oh, he's just made something move. It's great. It's like getting attention. It's like, look at me, I'm moving. And there is that element, but it's kind of a joke. I like that. It's like the keyboards. They're kind of, look at us. We're still here, you know. You thought we were redundant totally, but we've been brought back to life. And when you come in, we're so happy to see you. We're going to start moving. So there's a kind of pathos to, and a humour, I suppose, involved in that. So the reason it's a parody, the reason I see it as a parody. And again, this is kind of retrospective. It's not like I came up with this clever idea. Is that instead of autonomy, I just have automation.
Okay. So
automation is like a kind of parodic, degraded version of autonomy, right? So instead of self-determination and free will, you're just kind of plugged in, and you kind of repeat these things, which is actually how I see how we operate most of the time. I don't
exactly
think most of us is autonomous free will. I think most of us is kind of dumb repetition of stuff. We don't know quite why we're doing it, but we're kind of compelled to keep doing it, right? And it's not necessarily healthy, but it can be funny.
Mm-hmm. Life is funny.
You've got to laugh.
Does anyone have any questions?
I was wondering,
if you work with kinetic art and like house stuff, move or evolve. Oh, sorry. Can you just wait for the... Sorry, I should have been more... Sorry, I should have...
I was just wondering if you're ever interested to work with the organic to make that change so the viewer would always see it differently because it actually grows.
That would be amazing, yeah. I mean, that would be the show at Matt's is called Psychobotanical, and I'm kind of... my other intention is to make something that kind of creeps about, that crawls about the space. So, I suppose when you say organic, it depends. We're always using language metaphorically, so that's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, most of our language is our kind of metaphors of the body or of nature to begin with, you know. So... what do we mean by organic? But I would like to work, I hope I work a little bit organically at the moment, but to create a sculpture that would, or work, or any kind of work, you know, it could be video work, right, or something, that would self-generate in a way that we associate with life, that would make certain decisions that wouldn't be about a kind of conscious awareness, but they would nevertheless be about making choices. So it's not like a cloud that moves about. You know, the cloud moves, but the cloud's not alive because the cloud is just blown wherever the cloud is blown. But something like a tree, which does wave about, will grow in certain directions in order to benefit from the sunlight and so on, and to get maximum space for its roots and so on. So the tree is making decisions, and that's why the tree is alive. So, yeah, if I could make a work that actually makes decisions that are not pre-programmed decisions, then to me that would be organic. And, yeah, that would be an ambition I would have, actually. But it would be, it's quite a hard thing to do. But, yeah, I'd love to do that.
Is it on? It's on a bit. Thank you, both of you. It's very interesting. And it's kind of the theme I've picked up on from both of you is perhaps an unease about the art world, the gallery, and perhaps art education as well. And the expression that comes to mind is, you know, biting the hand that feeds you. Can you respond to that?
Do you want to say something?
Can you go first?
Yes, I do have big problems with it. I was thinking of... there used to be a critic called Stuart Morgan. He used to write for Freeze magazine at the start. He was quite well-respected. He was quite good writer. But I remember he was asked... he was asked what art he does like, and then he was asked what art he does like, and he gave a big, big, long answer, you know, a couple of pages. He was asked what he doesn't like, and he just said, art doesn't impinge on me. You know, I won't answer that. It doesn't impinge on me. And it always struck me as a very strange, slightly, for me, floating above it all kind of response, because, and it might be my own, you know, weaknesses personally or whatever, but art does impinge on me. I do think a lot of art is crap. I do wonder why it gets where it does. I do think it's an issue of class. I do think we need to think about this as art educators. I think that should be central to the way we kind of explain things, teach things. I think we should talk about the kind of mechanisms of things like autonomy that are about the way we understand and give meaning to art. And I can understand why somebody would want to avoid all the kind of pettiness of kind of, you know, little personality battles and wanting to get dragged in and upset by certain things. But I think, you know, there's various kind of ideas of what we mean by professional, right? Mm-hmm. They're not all good, but if professional means that you dedicate a lot of your time in your life to making art, to thinking about art, to curating art, whatever, if you're involved in it, then of course you have every right to and responsibility actually to think about what's good, what's bad, why it's good, why it gets there, how it gets there, how we can change things. You know, I mean, that's where, you know, it's never really about just you when you're making the art. It's always a kind, you know, you're always involved in a whole kind of proposition for what could happen in terms of how you're influenced by certain things. And so it is a kind of statement. Whatever you do is a kind of statement of where your position is. I don't know what you've...
I'm involved in... I teach. I have a long history of showing in publicly funded situations. And in the last couple of years, I'm now up to my neck in the commercial art world as well. What do I want to say? I mean, the problems around art education since the introduction of fees is pretty well rehearsed in terms of the demographic, in terms of whether somebody like me from a working class background would have been able to have taken the education that I'm now dishing out, for want of a better word. I think one of the biggest disappointments for me has been the public, has been the deference to the commercial and private art world by the public, by publicly funded institutions. I think that's an ongoing disappointment I have.
I think when
was I not supposed to say that?
No, I totally agree.
I didn't answer the question.
I just think if you if you talk about the biting the hand that feeds, yeah. I think we should think about who is this hand that feeds, and how did it get this food to feed us or whatever? You know, like, how did that happen? Which again goes to that thing about the interconnectedness of things. I mean, that the kind of fetish or the kind of illusion that a work is isolated from all the kind of mechanisms of kind of production, and often there is a lot of unseen labor that goes into things. I mean, in a way, a lot of my work has been, I suppose, looking back, it's been a kind of ongoing dialogue with kind of minimalist sculpture and some of those ideas, which, you know, go back to those ideas of, you know, being against kind of, you know, control and so on. But it seemed to me that minimalist art ended up really needing the institution very, very badly. Not just the institution, but the white cube that would just completely have to be forced to kind of clear every sign of any other kind of relation, social relation, out of it. And it went very much to the handing over the production to other people, other anonymous people. So I think probably we're both involved in making art, like keeping the production of work quite close to,
yeah.
I mean, what happens is if you hand it over to someone, then that struggle with the material itself completely changes.
Yeah.
It's like a different kind of thing. It becomes much more, you know, like pointing. Mm-hmm. Like this is a plan. You send it off and you get it delivered mm-hmm. back. So it's a completely different method mm-hmm. of working, which has a kind of inherent politics to it. But yeah, thanks.
Could you pause?
Hi, Dean.
Hello.
Emma. Good to hear you. It's good to hear about your work, actually. I like the fact that you repeat artworks and that, you know, there's a sense of not progressing. And I don't mean that in a bad way. And I know they do progress because you work out the technology and everything. But I think that's what strikes me about your work is this sort of anti-progression kind of. And maybe it's, I'm toying with this idea a lot in my own work and just in life in general, because there's part of me that still doesn't get modern life and this fact that you have to change and grow and kind of wants to be, you know, wants to remain the same and everything to remain the same. It is a fantasy because obviously I know that progression is necessary and growth is necessary, but that has got us in a lot of trouble, you know. Progression and growth, apparent progression and growth. Yeah, and the fact that you use like lo-fi, you know, analog technology, it's like return of the nerds or something, or you know, you can't get rid of that. They're sort of like your embarrassing past or something, you know, the keyboards and stuff like that. I just suppose because it's these repetitious loops the things are on and you know, they remind me of Pepper Rami's, the, you know, that advert. Yeah.
Bit of an animal.
Bit of an animal, bit of an animal, bit of a plant, bit of a finger, but not quite committing to any sort of thing. But they are really hilarious and they always make me laugh, and which is great. And but also there is this existential angst in there and this quite heavy sort of subject in a way, I think, that I don't quite understand, but it does affect you on a primal level. Yeah, so I suppose what I just wanted to know what you think about, is it deliberately anti-progressive, or how do you feel about, you know, remaking artworks over the years?
Yeah, it probably is. I mean, I don't... Well, it's a difficult thing. I mean, I want to say I don't really believe in progress. And what I suppose what I mean by that is I don't, you know, it's not like nothing gets better, right? Because some things get better, but then other things don't get better and other things get worse. And it could all get really bad, right? Like, things could get really bad. I'm not specifically interested in technology as well. Like, I'm not a nerd in the sense that I don't really know a lot about keyboards and stuff. Like, seriously, I mean, people assume I do, but I don't, and I don't, I'm not really that interested. I see them as, you know, I am quite, I'm quite affectionate towards them, like, in a sense, you know, it just sounds ridiculous, but I'm quite fond of them. I have my favourites, and I, like, they have idiosyncrasies, and so that kind of pathos, that kind of pathetic kind of pathos. Yeah. But, yeah, I think what you're getting at is kind of obsession, right? Which is slightly embarrassing. Like, yeah, you kind of... I don't really know the reason I do these things apart from there's a kind of obsessiveness of, and a kind of compulsion of just kind of having to repeat them. And I'll make them slightly different. I'll do them slightly different ways. It depends on the situation. Depends on the space. This is a very big space. This was a kind of amazing to have this space to show this work. And therefore I kind of utilize that space, but it's essentially the same thing. You know, there could be 100 of them, it would essentially be the same thing. You know, there's a kind of seriality to it, and they're all, you know, they're all just whatever, they're all just in the club, just whatever, doing their thing. Or there might just be one of them in the club doing it, you know, it's that they don't really care. So yeah, no. Well, I'm glad you. I'm glad you find them hilarious. And the pepperoni thing is really interesting. I mean, it's not like I'm there's something really kind of profound about the pepperoni, and that, and it goes back to your first question, which I probably didn't answer properly, but the part of the thing about silicon is its homogeneity, the fact that it's simple, it's basic, and in that sense it's an awful lot like a lot of commodities we might buy in Asda or something, which when you think about it is a bit disturbing and a bit weird, right? The fact that, you know, you kind of cut through this stuff, you have no idea really what it is, but it all kind of looks the same, and it might be meat or it might be chemicals or it might be kind of vegetable, or you don't really know, but there's a kind of simplicity to it, which is like plasticine, or it's like plastic, or it's like gelatine, or it's like all these kind of modern commodities that we, you know, we kind of spend our time with. But I think there is something, you know, fetishistic in the sense that we have a kind of attraction to this as some kind of substitution for various different things. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're kind of endearing. That's why they're kind of fascinating. You know, pepperoni or something, it's kind of fascinating. And that's why they can animate it in the adverts and so on, you know. So, yeah.
But also, as an artist, you have... Well, everyone has pressures that we must progress. We must, you know, achieve this and bigger and better. And I think it actually causes a lot of misery. It kind of goes against maybe something about human nature, which maybe is to fester and die, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I do enjoy using stuff that other people are getting rid of, I suppose, you know. So I'm like Dr. Frankenstein, a kind of cheap version of Dr. Frankenstein, kind of bringing these things back to a kind of, you know, a half-life, you know, kind of reanimating them or something. I suppose I don't want to get to that point of doing kind of animatronics that are kind of pre-programmed or anything like that. You know, that feels far too slickly, professionally kind of engineered, and that's really not what it's about. And sometimes that does happen, and does happen with some of the artists I've been very influenced by.
Paul McCarthy,
yeah. Exactly. So the early Paul McCarthy, yeah. Moving, you know, there's some guy fucking a tree, yeah. And it's just brilliant, yeah. You know, he's just managed to get this stuff from the TV studio cupboard, you know, and you know, he's got a tree, and he's got, you know, and he's animated this, and that's what it is, right? It's this kind of movement, you know, it's this kind of in-out movement, right? It's this kind of fucking movement, or this kind of, you know, ridiculous kind of simple movement which operates an awful lot of the kind of stuff that we interact with every day, but it does it on the most basic level of it's just a motor going round, which is the most basic movement of, you know, it's a kind of cosmic movement, you might say, if that doesn't sound too grand or something, but that's what it is. It's just the circle turned into a kind of in-out movement through a cam. So yeah, that's what
it just loops.
It's completely dumb. It's a dumb loop, and it works by plugging something in, and that's it. So yeah, Paul McCarthy, you know, the last kind of stuff I saw.
Well, he's under the pressure of progress, maybe.
And he's got so much money, and Howes and Worth will give, you know, they give so much money. Stop, what else can you do with it? But kind of have this massive animatronic kind of pre-programmed thing.
But his paintings are good. He's been doing paintings.
No, I think he's great, and his videos are great. And but I think the point is there is a kind of economy, there is a kind of efficiency with art that. It's better to do something amazing out of something little, you know, than obviously. But there is a lot of kind of doing not that much with a lot. And if you go along, if you walk along the street here to Damien Hirst Gallery, that to me, that is the ultimate kind of example of that. And I find it sad, you know, I find it sad and so lacking in any joy or any kind of human quality, really, that building and what happens in that building and the amount of money that goes into getting all of Jeff Koons' work into that gallery, etc. And I can't imagine anything ever being interesting in that gallery. But that doesn't stop loads of people going.
There is a good show on
there. Oh, it's a good show on there. Okay, yeah.
Have we got any more questions from the floor? Because it's probably time to wrap up.
Can I just like, just because I've got the opportunity, so I'd really like to thank you, Naomi, and David, and Eben, and Simon, and everyone else at Beaconsfield. So it's been, I've just been up there, and I've actually got really kind of a bit sad, thinking that it's going to close down tomorrow, because it has been really brilliant doing the show, and I'm really... You know, I'm really not happy with all the art I make, but I'm happy with this work, and it's kind of perfect for this space. So, thank you.
Thank you for coming and working, and thanks very much, Emma. There were some great, really probing questions, and it was really interesting conversation. I'm sure you're all agreeing. Nobody walked out, so it's got to have been interesting. So the show's still on, and. Do go and have a look if you didn't get the chance. It looks as though the bar's closed, actually. It looks like Eben's gone home. So I think if you want a drink, it's going to be across the road. But thanks very much for coming.
Thank you. Oh, is someone
no,
here?
It's great. No.
Sorry.
Thank you very much. It was really interesting. And I'm so glad we recorded it, because actually...
I'd love a copy.
Are you all right? We might just put it on the website.
On the website, I'll get a copy from there. I thought it was...
That'd be brilliant.
You sounded really...
You can cut that last bit out.
Okay.
But I do think... Bye,
Sandy. Good luck. Yeah. Okay, see you later. Yeah.
Look, as an outsider, the talk, it was brilliant. You said some really, 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 really good things. Like, you said all the things you wanted you to say, and I think you're just a genius. Yeah.
You're both really articulate.
No, I mean,
he's a really...
Yeah, but you kept him on the button. Yeah.